name's Sharon Barker. I'm an alcoholic. And it gives me a lot of pleasure to be with all of you this morning. I'd rather be up there than up here, but you know. It's all about fitting myself to be of maximum service to God and his fellows. And I looked for my purpose my whole life. Looked for peace and purpose. And I found King Alcohol, and I became a prisoner of the disease of alcoholism. I would be remiss if I didn't let you know I've had a wonderful time. And Amy has been just there for my every need and anticipating it. And we've had a lot of fun, and I've seen some old friends, and I've met some new friends, and I've had a lot of laughs with some other friends. And there's some members of my home group who have moved away who are in this room just to keep me honest, I'm sure. And God's got his way. And had a lot of fun with a walk with Jim yesterday. Went on a walk. And it's a Al-Anon wife went off to do her walk with the Al-Anons. And so four of us alcoholics went out and did a walk. And he's hard to keep up with. He's put him in that spandex and he's gone. You know? But you can sense the feeling that this convention has had. The love that's gone into it, because I love the greeters. They were competitive. I think I hugged one last night. She said, "That's number 14 to the guy next to her. I mean, you know, it's just like, give alcoholics, you know, a mark to keep, and we'll keep score, boy, I'll tell you. And it's just been a lot of fun, and it gives me great joy to see some old friends like Tom and Camille and meet some new friends, Rusty. And my sponsor, Clancy, who jetted out this morning because he's got two commitments today. Rust never sleeps. And but he left me a message. I'm glad he didn't wake me up. It was about 6 in the morning or 5:30 or something. So I thought he was kind, and he left me a message, which I thought was nice. And his usual one, don't screw up, you know. Lovingly, of course. And it's just, it's such a joy to see all of us into the countdown, and it's always such an emotional thing. And Susan, with 2 days, we have some connections. And I wish her well. And the people that were holding up the babies, you know, 9 months, someone held up a 9-month-year-old, and that so many days, somebody else held up a baby, you know. And that's what I said to her. I said, "You're like a baby. Let us take care of you." And because if Alcoholics Anonymous would have said, "You're too sick," or "You look too bad," or "Go sit in the kitchen a while until you clean up," or they loved me until I knew what was even going on. I had no idea I was at Alcoholics Anonymous. I think on August 20th, 1975, if the Hare Krishnas would have bounded in my life, that's where I'd be today. Because I was at that point in my life, and the book talks about it, the one word you've heard a lot this weekend, surrender. I was at that point where I finally, in a very quiet little voice, inaudible to the human ear but audible to my God's ear, I said, "I give up. I give up." And the ego kept me going for a long time. The big I, the self, the me, the mine. I don't remember that much about my childhood because I was so self-absorbed. I have to get the information from my sisters much of the time. I do remember I loved the movie The Lost Weekend. That was one of my favorite movies I loved when a kid. You know, not very many children go, "Don't look in the light," when the bottle is there and they're coming looking for the bottle. And don't look in the light because that's where his bottle is, you know. And I related to that guy before I ever had a drink. I have no idea why, you know. So that was one of my favorite movies growing up. And I have a normal family. They're still normal, you know. I'm Catholic, but I'm not Irish. So it doesn't matter. Alcohol worked for me. Alcohol did something for me. It didn't do for my friend Janet sitting next to me when I was 13 going on 14 years old, sitting on a 57 Chevy out on an Iowa road in the country. Canadian Club and Schlitz beer going around, and boy, it hit my toes. It warmed. It went down easy. It went down good. And now all of a sudden there I was, standing up chug-a-lugging with the boys, popping the cans on, you know, opening it in the bottom and popping it in the top, and, you know, chug-a-lug contest right away, you know, 6-7 seconds down my throat. You know, this is my first outing with alcohol. It was just like, you know, a young girl trying on a pair of high heels for the first time. They just fit right in there. And I don't remember much about the evening because I did have a blackout, but I do remember the next morning I couldn't wait to do it again because something happened. It was like the Emerald City. It turned my life into technicolor. It made all the people in my head shut up. They all got drunk. All those people that judged me and talked about me and what if and if only and you're not good enough and all of that. You know, they all got drunk and we had a wonderful time. And you know, they still live there. You know, alcoholism centers in the mind. It talks about that in the book. It took me years to find that. And I, oh, yeah, that's it. That's why I keep coming to the meetings, because when I'm with you, my heart opens up and my mind gets quiet. And it is a language of the heart. It is one drunk talking to another. It is a family of understanding. I had not met anyone like you before, because there were people in my life, too, that said, I understand, or let's try this, or nobody did understand. There wasn't one person there that understood, and if you're a good alcoholic, you're not going to really tell the truth anyway. And I wasn't telling the truth as I went along my life. And after high school, I got into a lot of trouble in college. In my family, you went to college, and you got educated, and you kind of had your little road laid out for you, and that's what you were going to do, and that's what my sisters and my brother, that's what they have done. And then there was me, and they began to worry about me at an early age because I was coming home dressed funny with funny-looking people with funny-looking eyes. And it was the late 60s. It wasn't just say no generation. It was just say thanks. And we took a lot of extra stuff with our alcohol. But even my friends used to say, oh, Sharon, you're such a juicer. Why do you have to drink? And I said, I love to drink. I always drank. And all of a sudden, I'm not in that nice sorority anymore. I'm marching on Washington. I'm disrupting courtrooms. I'm at the Love-In in Wisconsin. I'm at a rock festival. I'm hitchhiking to go get my moratorium button at the next event. And, you know, my father and my mother are beginning to worry a little bit about daughter number two. And my mother would say, oh, Sharon's just footloose and fancy-free. And I was into it. My father began to really worry about me. I had a suicide attempt, and he brought the priest down, and the priest and I got drunk, and it was, we have a way of turning people around if they have potential, you know. We can kind of bring them right into our life for a moment, and at the end of that evening, they were, you know, he was hugging my friends in the student union, you know, the Black Panthers, the SDS people. We were like comrades for the moment, and it was my father standing in the background with his set jaw and his arms folded, and he just doesn't know what to make of this at all. And pretty soon I write my dad a letter, and I tell him what I think's going on with the world, and I'm angry. I don't know why I'm so angry. I don't know why I'm so empty. I don't know why I'm so hopeless, and I don't tell him those things. I just attack. I attack so that you don't look at me. And I didn't know that I was beginning the long road of that lonely disease of alcoholism, that lonely disease. You know, it talks about King Alcohol and that we were, you know, shivering denizens of his mad realm and the chill vapor of loneliness that settles down around us. I mean, that's in A Vision for You. Thank God they let you read most of the book to get up to that point in A Vision for You. Oh, because when I read that every time, I just get chills because that's what it did for us. You know, it worked for us, and then it did it to us. That's what it did to me. It took any sense of spirit or life away. Just ran out my sleeves. And I gave it willingly. Willingly, I gave those pieces of myself. My father and I had a huge fight, and that was it. I ended up in New York and lived there for a while and looked for truth in every corner and, you know, took a lot of LSD with my alcohol and drank till 4 in the morning and had the bumps on my head red and my tarot done a lot and the I Ching. And I'm working in an ad agency and I'm a mad woman. I'm up all the time because I found, you know, something called crystal meth. So I'm up all the time and I go in the bars close to about 4 or 5 in the morning, and sometimes I wouldn't even sleep. I just put on my nice work clothes and off on the subway and eat some LSD before I go. And that's what I did for about 10 months on a frantic search looking for truth. And I found it briefly, you know. It was always as the elevator door was closing, wait a minute, you know, or the it'd be written on the subway wall, melting, you know, can't write fast enough, you know. And And they drank hard and heavy in this ad agency, and they could just close your door. You had hangovers. People closed their doors in the morning. We went out and we drank lunches together, and it was just an insane time. And when I lived my life in paranoia and paper bags, breathing in paper bags, and I didn't know this was alcoholism. I just thought it was anxiety of living in New York. And the mugger came and got me, and I was happy he was there, and I gave him everything. God, you'd finally come. I mean, I waited for this guy. I lived in paranoia of this mugger for months. And when he came, I thanked him, gave him everything, and I knew I could go home. And I went back to college, and I didn't know I was taking geographics. I went back to art class, and that's one thing I could do is I could sit and paint. And now when I went back to art class, I couldn't sit and paint anymore. There was an emptiness inside of me that just was dead. And I didn't know that was the first big part of my soul that I was going to lay on the table and say, here, you take part of my soul, bartender, give me a rock glass full of Jose Cuervo gold. That's all. It's okay. Peace of my soul is fine. Alcohol better work tonight. That was just one of the first times I noticed that was happening in my life. I went to Colorado because I wanted to be a cowgirl. Met Bob Dylan, came to California. Not sure if it was Bob Dylan. Not still to this day, sure. But I ended up at a commune in California, and I turned 21 dancing with the Krishnas in Westwood, and then they talked about forever and giving up my worldly possessions and coming off with them, and I said, no, I do a day at a time, and put my backpack back on. I lived a day at a time long before I came to you, and when you said it's a day at a time, when I got here, I went, I still didn't trust you, you know, sure, yeah, right, forever, a day at a time, I know what you mean, 5 years, a day at a time, 5 years at a crack, sure. But I lived a day at a time, and people that wanted my soul forever or my life forever or a commitment from me never got it. I didn't get married because it was paperwork. You know, it was just stuff. I didn't sign anything. And I came back from California after living that commune with $4 and a dog. I had made a profit, and I had a great time, and it was good. Life was still okay. But I went back to Colorado, and they had rented out my little cabin, you know. My wino landlady didn't save it for me. I didn't understand it. My drinking pal. And I went to get my things back, and I couldn't ask. I couldn't ask those people living in my cabin, wearing my clothing, using my things. I could not ask for what belonged to me back. I got my photographs, and I left. And when that screen door slammed behind me, I remember standing there thinking, go back, turn around, go get your stuff. And I couldn't do it. I thought, what is wrong with you? That you can't go back and just claim your things and pack up and leave. And I didn't know what was wrong with me, but it was another piece of my soul gone that I noticed. I noticed that day something was awry with me. I ended up living with my mother and father. I was very ill. My dad and I didn't speak. My mother said, just stay out of his way and don't take any drugs in this house. So I drank, and I drank a lot. And my dad and I couldn't ride in the same car. We couldn't sit at the same table. We couldn't be in the same room. Oh, I remember he didn't like the smell of nail polish, so I would put nail polish on in the other room so that it would waft in and get to him, you know. And he didn't like ice crunching, so I would sit there and crunch ice if he was within ear distance, you know. And just because, you know, he had big shoulders, my dad. He was my hero. And I thought, I'm going to give it to him because I hurt so bad. But I wasn't going to tell you that. They sent me to psychiatrists. They sent me to doctors. And I folded my arms and kicked out my feet. And I said to you, nothing. You know, I said nothing to you. I thought, you can just figure it out. You know, we're paying you. And I had a bad attitude. And they were worried about me, my family was. I met somebody who said that he'd take care of me, and that was fine. I was starting to get very toxic and very sick, and I didn't know what was wrong. And I was a loser. I was sitting in that hometown with all the losers at the local taverns in that little town in Iowa. And I ended up in northern Wisconsin at an organic farm where I thought that was going to be, you know, my life was just living on this organic farm with this guy that was kind of okay, but he took care of me, and we had 50 head of organic sheep and 85 acres of organic land and organic honeybees, organic maple trees, and Phil got organic. They took away my cigarettes. They made me organic. They gave me organic pot to smoke. They took away my alcohol. They gave me organic wine to drink, and we had organic wheat berries that we made organic bread out of. We had organic wood that we cooked out. You know, we'd make a cup of tea, got to chop wood. It was just organic. Everything was work and organic. And I get thirsty every once in a while, you know. These other people didn't understand. I'd be standing out there with buckets of sap up to my thighs and snow going, I need a drink. What am I doing here, you know? Puffing on this organic pot all the time, morning to night, going, this isn't getting it anymore. And one night I was in my rocking chair rocking, and he had his banjo playing music on, and he never learned to play that banjo, and it sounded real irritating that night. And I was, cat was flicking his tail, you know, and I'm reading the latest issue of Mother Earth News, you know. And some of you people probably know about that up here in this part of the woods. And you know, the dog's got his tongue hanging out, and he's looking at me, and the guy misses another note, and I just flew out of that chair, and I got into my station wagon with the ball tires and the big sun painted on the hood, and named Cheshire. You got to name those kind of cars, or they never last. You know, you got to name them. And I went into that general store. There was one just store in this corner of town, and I went in, and I had two cheap bottles of wine. I got the dust off the wine. I mean, that's the kind of community it was. And I came home, and I put that wine on the table, and it was starting to snow hard and heavy, and I didn't care. I didn't care if I had to be with that guy for 2 days, just snow, stuck in the snow with him. And I didn't care now because I had my wine. Boy, there was some relief just having it on the table. A couple glasses later, you know, he went to bed. He had seen me drunk in those Iowa taverns. And he went to bed, and Pete Seeger went across the room like a frisbee, and the Rolling Stones came on their record player, and the cat, the dog, and I were a lot happier. And I thought, why am I letting these people do this to me? You know, there's relief in alcohol. I felt such relief. You know, it was the only time anybody tried to control and enjoy my drinking for me, I'll tell you. Pretty soon I became such a bad drunk, eventually they asked me to please not be a part of their circle. They blackballed me from the organic farmer circle up there. Just, sayonara, you know, it's fine with me. And I was alone that summer, and we had planted a half acre of marijuana before he left. So we had this organic pot growing, and then he left that to me, which I thought was very nice. So that's what I did that summer. I tended the pot, I drank my wine, me and the dog and the cat and the horse. Occasionally we'd have some money, we'd sell some organic vegetables that the weeds weren't taking over. That pot patch didn't have one weed in it, but the vegetables had a lot of weeds in it. I go into town and have some money and get drunk and put my cowboy boots on, and boy, I let the hair on my legs grow. I was just free, you know. I was just me. It was all I wanted. I was really happy. And I harvested my pot and I took it into town to sell it. But the one thing was, I forgot it. I left it back on the farm. And these people, you know, said, where's the pot? And I forgot. And so I joined the carnival because it was there. You know? Truly. Could have been a revival tent and would have been with them. You know, anyway, out of town at that moment. Anyway, out of Boyceville, Wisconsin, I'll tell you. And so that's where I was going, was with the carnival. And, you know, I used to think that the grass was always greener, you know. I thought that all the time. It's a new, fresh start and fresh people, and nobody knows anything about me. I change my name a lot, you know, just to have some fun with it. And, you know, I got with the show, and I ended up somewhere down south and called my mother from Arkansas, and she said, what are you doing? I said, I'm running a shooting gallery, Mom, and with a carnival. And she started to cry. Oh, it's just, you know, I can't talk to my dad. Now my mom cries when I call home. And, you know, let's just go have another drink. And those guys lived hard and heavy, and, you know, you blew in and blew out of town, and I loved it. You know, every 3 or 4 days, you got a fresh start in a fresh town. And somewhere down south, I don't know, I created a little bit of havoc, and the show got closed from one of the Louisiana states. I think it was Monroe, Louisiana. And a couple stops later, I wake up in the morning, someone's beating on my door, and I should have known it wasn't one of my partying friends. And it was early in the morning, and as I cracked open that door, a boot came and shoved that door open, and a shotgun went in my belly and put me up against the wall. And they searched that room, you know. It was some of Franklinton Parish finest, and they found enough for sales and possession. I mean, it was only for my personal use, but they got me for sales and possession. And my newfound him was there, and so lucky him, he gets to go to jail. And his pet skunk was there, so this pet skunk went to jail, and the dog went to jail, and we all went off to jail, and my carnival worker friends left town, my good friends, my good buddies. Nobody came by to see if I was going to need a magazine or a carton of cigarettes. And there I was in jail, screaming for my rights. Nobody had read me my rights. Like, they cared. They didn't care, you know. They finally gave me my rights 3 days later just so I'd shut up. Typewritten on a piece of paper, here's your rights, shut up. And a couple days later, they gave me a phone call, and I'm just nuts. I had never been at a point like this, you know, and I have no alcohol. I'm detoxing in there. And I made this phone call to my brother-in-law in New York, and he called my dad, and I didn't know that. And about 2 or 3 days later, they said I had a visitor. They slapped handcuffs on me. They took me to this little building and put me in this room, and there's my father sitting there. And I couldn't look at my dad. My dad couldn't look at me. It was one of those days that I just wish I could have evaporated, that I wasn't worth anything anyway. Why don't you just let me melt? And my dad and I have talked about that day. It took us many years to talk about that day. A couple years ago we talked about that day. And he said the only thing I told him all day long was that I was not guilty. And that's a good victim. It's a real good victim when you can just appease your guilt to somebody else, something else. You know, there was no guilt in my life. It wasn't my fault. And he sat there with his tight jaw, and I sat there fighting back the tears. And I couldn't reach out and touch him, and he couldn't reach out and touch me. We couldn't say we cared about each other because alcoholism had gotten between us. King alcohol ruled there. And went back to jail, and then they let me loose, and they said, go make money. You're going to pay a big fine. You might do time. And I found New Orleans, and I fell in love with New Orleans. I mean, this new boyfriend, now we're together from like blood brothers. We hate each other. We were in love for 2 weeks, and we hated each other for 2 years. But we're in this, you know, we've got this felony thing on our heads, and we have to make this money. And so he, you know, he started working tugboats, and I became a dancer on Bourbon Street. And I drink, you know, and I make friends with the bartender, and he drank Cavassier, and he gave me a lot of Cavassier before I get on that little baby grand piano. It wasn't a grand piano, it was a baby grand, and I don't know if you remember platform shoes, they've been back a while again, but I used to wear these huge platform shoes and dance on a baby grand piano, drunk on Cavassier, with fishnet stockings that would get stuck on the props on the wall all the time, because I'd have to lean, you know, because I can't balance these platforms on this baby grand, you're just so high, you know, and they want this little dance number from you, you know. These people have come to cheer and have this little dance number, and I had to do my job, and so I would kind of slither on the wall and get stuck on the palm tree always, you know. So we just slithered on the palm tree a while, and it was a short career. Not one I put on my resume, and I became a bartender because it was on a flat surface, and I did that well. And I remember working one of the nice hotels. I got a nice job, and we had to go back to court and pay a big fine, and that was, you know, I thought was behind me, and I had a probation officer that would meet me in the bar, and we would talk about things, and but it had a felony on my record. You know, it was a felony. That was what was now on my record. So things had changed a little bit for me. But I didn't care. I'm drinking with the kind of people I want to drink with. The people down there called the quarter rats. We never came out if it was daylight. We just didn't. I got fired for that nice hotel for being drunk on the job. And I had to sign a piece of paper. You know, it's like, quit, you fired. And that piece of paper went into a general computer so nobody would hire me. That was a nicer place down in New Orleans as a bartender. And I started, screw them, who needs them anyway. I started working local places. You know, I don't know if you've been down to the French Quarter, but there's some places that are, you know, really stuck back in there. And those are the kind of places I like to work, because you worked at another one, and you come into my shift, and I'd take good care of you, and you'd have a tab, and I go into yours when I'm done, and I can spend 2 days in your bar if I want. The Bastille was one of my favorite places. I remember coming to out of a blackout, having a chug-a-lug contest in the Bastille. I'm in a blackout coming to. I've got the Chosen Few on both sides of me, which is one of the biker gangs down there, and I'm chug-a-lugging this green chartreuse out of a rock glass. I'm in the middle of a chug-a-lug contest as I'm coming out of my blackout, thinking I'm not taking care of myself very much in my blackouts anymore. The 4th of July that year, I was in Florida driving the wrong way on a freeway with people I didn't know screaming as I came to out of my blackout. I'm beginning to worry a little bit about myself now. It's not as much fun as it used to be. I would end up in violent situations with violent people, and this boyfriend of 2 years that we just hated each other, you know, he had this heroin habit. I didn't understand that at all. And he would come home, and I had my new best friend there, and he didn't understand. He wasn't part of the peace and love generation where, you know, my name was Cher, S-H-A-R-E, Cher and Cher alike, you know, and I used to tell my dad that, and boy, I watched my dad's jaw just get so tight when I tell him that, and, you know, I just, I lived like that, and they came to visit me when I was living with that guy, and I had a new black eye, and I don't know what he had. He'd pass out from heroin. I'd give him a kick or two sometimes, but the skunk was running around. There were droppings in the room. It was a tar paper roof apartment. There were screaming women next door that, you know, were women of the evening, and it was above a biker bar, and it was in a bad part of the French Quarter, and you know, mom and dad from Iowa come visit daughter number two. And I know they weren't expecting the platinum blonde wig and the black eye, I'll tell you that. And they weren't expecting him, my newfound him. And they took us out to lunch or something. And I remember my dad couldn't look at me, and I couldn't look at my dad. And we didn't say a word to each other. And my mother's tears, I remember, rolled into her baked potato. And that's what I remember about that whole day, except when they left. And remember when they left, I wanted to crawl in the back seat and take her sweater and wrap it around me and just, let me go home, Mom. I'm so tired. You don't get it. I don't do this because I want to do this. I do this because I have to do this. I didn't tell her that. I didn't know that. I just knew it was hopeless. Absolutely hopeless. And I knew if I went home, nothing would change. Nothing would change. So alcoholism had me. I was in the palm of King Alcohol's hand. And I was there, lock, stock, and barrel. Everything that was important to me was gone. I remember going and sitting down at that bar and ordering my tequila just so that I could turn off those feelings. And the feelings didn't turn off. And that was beginning to happen occasionally. And his boyfriend finally left and went to St. Louis, and I should have been happy he was gone, but I had decided I wasn't in on this breakup thing, and my ego was involved, so I followed him there, and it took me a couple months to find him, and when he did, he got off his motorcycle, and he took off his helmet, and he cracked the window where I was sitting, and he pulled me out by my hair and said, if I ever see you again, I'll kill you. And that's when I knew the relationship was over. That's what it took for me. I'm the kind of alcoholic that just hangs on so tight. And I had this wonderful sponsor. My second sponsor, Jenny, said, you know, she heard this story. I was telling her about this guy. And she said, Sherry, you like this woman, that this story I hear in Alcoholics Anonymous, of this woman who walked around for a long time with her hand in a fist. And nobody would, you know, ever, nobody would ever be able to let her open it. You know, she just didn't want to open it and let people look inside what she was guarding and holding and her fist so tightly. And after a number of years, you know, she trusted one person enough to peel back the fingers of what this woman had was holding and guarding, and it was close to her heart. And she said, it's a turd. You're holding a turd. You're guarding a turd, you know? And when Jenny told me that story, my feelings were kind of hurt, you know, that she thought of me as somebody who just hung on to kind of turds in my life. And, you know, I looked at her with all my almost 5 years of sobriety, and I said, I know, Jenny, but it was my turd. Belonged to me. And Alcoholics Anonymous has allowed me to let go of the turds. It really has. Now, at least it's allowed me to loosen my grip. And I, New Orleans just was the end of my drinking. It was 1975, was not a good year. I had my best friend, one of my good drinking pals, shot and killed, Mardi Gras Day, 2 feet to my left. I was partying with Michael, and Michael drank like I drank, and he was just kind of over the edge that night. I don't know what happened. And he was a bouncer at Pat O'Brien's, and I guess he had a gun, and he knew all the cops on the beat, and I guess the cop that shot him said, Michael, don't put it away. Michael put it away. He begged him to put it away, and Michael did, and he lowered the gun and aimed it right at the policeman, and he shot him, killed him. And I think Michael was in a blackout. I was in a blackout. I came to, and he was laying 2 feet to my left, dead. And Norm Alpe was a speaker that spoke a lot when I was new in Alcoholics Anonymous. He taught me a lot of things by listening to this guy, and he taught me about seconds and inches. And boy, if you think back over your life, every single one of us sitting in here have our seconds and inches, that we get to come to the doors of Alcoholics Anonymous, that we are the lucky ones. We may never win a lottery in our life, but we beat it. We beat the odds by sitting in a room of Alcoholics Anonymous. And it's because of this fellowship being passed along, like Tom was talking about, that people took the time to make it what it is in their home group with what they got, and to pass that along to somebody else. And there are people here from my home group who have taken what they've learned and they've taken it out and spread the news, you know. And I had no idea that I was getting ready for you. I ended up in New York, and in New York I came across country, some people that tried to control and enjoy my drinking for me again. I was such a bad drinker, they didn't want me around. One of them is since dead from alcoholism. We ended up at a bar in West Hollywood called Barney's Beanery, and I become unemployable. Nobody wanted to hire me. I was there a while. I came back to New Orleans. I was in New Orleans God, keep moving. I couldn't stand it anymore. I couldn't stay in one place. I couldn't be with you. I was ready to just fly apart all the time, especially if the alcohol wasn't working and quieting the demons inside of me. And I got back to New Orleans, and I remember I couldn't speak. And finally we went somewhere, and I had enough to drink, and I could start to talk. And my old friends didn't want to be around me. The old place down in Decatur Street didn't want to hire me back. Lower Decatur Street, smelly part of town, bad wino part of town. They didn't want me back. And I met somebody going to Hawaii, and we went to Hawaii, where we ended up in Barney's Beanery. That's as far as I got. I never got to Hawaii. I had some DTs on him and scared him, and he left. Lightweight, I guess. I don't know. But I'm sitting on that bar stool. I'm in a red dashiki and a Panama hat, and I'm over 170 pounds, and I have red splotches on my face because I don't look in the mirror anymore because it just hurts what I see in there. I think about that sick soul and where I'd be, because I went back to a class reunion recently, and I know I would have been another one just framed in black that they would have talked about. It's too bad, you know, it's too bad that she had to die, because I was right there with my foot in death's door. And somebody said, let's go to Palm Springs, and they had Harleys, and I loved bikes, so I got on the back and we went. And somewhere in the course of the evening, they didn't want to party with me, and I asked them why, and they said they needed a little extra weight for the back tire, and they looked around the bar and found the fattest one, and it was me. So I was just a little extra weight going out to the windy night in the desert, getting to Palm Springs. And I found two more friends to party with, and these guys didn't speak my language, and I didn't speak theirs, but it didn't matter. And I was in a blackout, and I don't remember much about the evening, thank God. I remember just enough bits and pieces to know how much humiliation there was. And when I came to, I was in an apartment complex somewhere, and they were kicking me in the face with their boots, and it wasn't a DT, this was really happening, and they were raping me, and I was screaming, and at some point in the evening, I just said, who the hell cares anyway? And that was my surrender. Who the hell cares anyway? I didn't care. You didn't care. I had shut God out a long time ago in that confessional back in a Catholic church. I had run screaming from a priest who was screaming at me. And I didn't care anymore. And they took me outside of town and rolled me off the side of the road. I had a concussion, a broken jaw in three places. My nose was pretty mashed flat. I was scraped and bruised and banged up and naked. And they threw me off the side of the road and guess they drove away. And the next thing I remember was I heard the car door slam. And it got me up just enough to hear a voice that said, get up, I want to live. I don't know who said it. If I could have turned my head, I would have looked around and said, who said that? But it stirred something inside of me, seconds and inches, you know, because I was in a concussion, I was in a blackout, I should have just baked. And what happened was I heard that voice. Just my turn, that's all, just my turn. And I got up, and I guess I ended up in a lawn chair by somebody's condominium, a foot from the pool, seconds and inches, you'd have another speaker, another foot. And the gardener found me, called the police, I ended up in the hospital, the next time I came to, I'm lying on a gurney, and I'm writing on this clipboard, on this piece of paper, because they're asking me questions, where were you, who were you with, yeah, it was Pedro, I don't remember, you know, where was I? And I saw a word in front of my name that just made my heart stop, and the word was victim. I thought, God, they know. Thank God they know. That's who I am, victim. And that was my identity in life. And as I was going into surgery, I heard the voice again. And the voice said, you know, it's not your dad's fault. Your sister, the Mensa, not her fault. You're lying here. Not those guys. Those guys didn't even do this to you. The Catholic Church, George, who broke your heart at 18. You did this to you. Boy, I've been looking for truth a long time, and when it finally came, I wasn't ready to hear it. I laid in the hospital for 2 weeks, and nobody sent me an airline ticket. And that was God working in my life. And nobody came to bail me out, and that was God working in my life. And nobody said, here's an opportunity in Phoenix, Arizona. All you got to do is go there in a bus and you can, you know, get there. Nobody did anything for me. I laid in that hospital with myself for 2 weeks. And I lived above a liquor store in West Los Angeles because somebody said they felt sorry for me, and I had to go back to court. They caught these guys, and I had to go back to these doctors. And I don't think much about it, but just happened to be a doctor in the hospital that morning when they pulled me in. That was one of the best plastic surgeons in Southern California. I used to do a lot of the rich people in Palm Springs. And when they put my face back together, he put the scars in places you can't see, you know. He put me back together real well. I never even thought about that for years, but that was God working in my life. And seconds and inches, just seconds and inches. And I ended up living by this liquor store with a guy buying me red wine every day before I go to work. And I would stick a straw on the top of that cheap red wine and stick a straw through the wires in my mouth where the tooth had been. And I would suck on the red wine, you know. Still had to drink. There was no more fun in alcohol, though. It was gone for me. It was over. And on August 20th, he said, you're depressing. You have to leave. And I thought, depressing? Depressing. You know, I sat there with a wired jaw and didn't speak for, about 2 weeks. Just sucked on my red wine and sat there like a lump. And I called my mom, and my mom didn't know for 2 days whether I was going to be okay or not okay, because she had gotten a phone call from somebody in California, from some hospital somewhere, that her daughter had been beaten up and raped and had these problems. And it took her 2 days to find me by dialing the telephone, her and my sister. So for 2 nights, my mother didn't sleep. And I'll tell you, if nothing else, I have overpaid that my mom gets to sleep at night. And Alcoholics Anonymous, I have to thank for that. And my mom said words to me that I'm a mom, I don't know if I could say. She said, Sharon, I can't help you anymore. Why didn't you go to the Salvation Army? And if she would have said just $20 more and please don't call home anymore, you hurt this family so much. I'm premenstrual, I'm sorry. Sorry. Anyway, I don't know where that came from. A little humor. She said, no, Sharon, go to the Salvation Army. And what happened was I called in the girl I had known from Barney's Beanery. She said, I can't help you, but Suzanne can. And I didn't know why Chris didn't want to help me that day. But Chris had been sober a little bit in Alcoholics Anonymous, and then she'd drink and come to Barney's and have her big book there, and she'd go off to these meetings. I remember taking my tequila one day and wishing her well with a rock glass full of gold. Good for you, Chris. Go to ANA. And they had to call her a cab. She couldn't drive. She was too drunk to go to Alcoholics Anonymous. But she was always nice to me, and I called her that day, and she said, you know, I can't help you, but Suzanne can. And I called this woman Suzanne just because I needed help. I just needed a place to stay. That was my next move in life, was a place to just give me a floor somewhere, because I have to go back to court, and I have to go back to these doctors, and I was tired. I didn't want to do anything anymore. I didn't want to go stick my thumb out. I was tired. And Suzanne said, put your drink down, put your joint down. And I thought, how does she know I have both? You know, right away she read my mail. I didn't know that I was going to be 12-step that day. She said, go sit in the steps and wait for these girls to come get you. I thought, okay. She just gave me direction, okay. You know, and I went and sat on these steps, and these two girls got out of this Volkswagen, and they were pretty and clean and nice, and I hated them. I didn't want to go anywhere with them. I knew that if they would have known what they had and sitting in their car, they would have just dumped me off at the nearest riverbed somewhere. And they talked to me incessantly. I remember that. We got to this church, and there I said, oh, that's it. Here we go. It's one of those where you're, you know, what have you done with your life? What's wrong with you? And commit forever, and here we go. And I walked up to the man with a tie on standing at the door, and he said, welcome. And I wasn't ready for that. I was ready for, you look terrible, go sit in the kitchen. You know, I had this broken jaw and this raccoon face, and everything was kind of pushed around, and my shoes were broken, my jeans were ripped, and my bleach-stained T-shirt was probably filthy dirty, and I smelled bad. And they put me right in front. Now, I don't relate any of this until months later, thinking about my first days in Alcoholics Anonymous. They put me right in front. I didn't know how they knew I was new, and I got all this attention. And you know, you could smell me walking in the door. I know that. Where's the newcomer? You know, they take a big whiff, you know? I don't smell that much anymore, you know. People are too cleaned up, and every once in a while I get that whiff at a meeting and I just follow it, you know. It's like, all right, you know, and something about that aroma that just brings me right back. And I don't remember much what happened except they tried to push this book down my throat. I passed the 20 questions with 17, and, you know, some man said he waited for the spaceship to land and said, "You can come home now, Bill." And I thought, oh, God, he knows how I feel. I always looked at the Iowa skies for the mothership. I knew, and I identified. One line out of his whole talk is all I remember, but I identified. And what happened was that identification gave me just a touch of hope, just a drop of hope. And I went back, and they waited for the liquor store lights to turn off. That's what their sponsors had said, wait for the liquor store lights to turn off. I landed in the Pacific Group, which is where I am today. Those people just took care of me until I could take care of myself. They moved me out of the liquor store, and they moved me onto somebody's floor, and I just kind of roved around with a sleeping bag that was borrowed, and I had a paper bag of mismatched goods and a big book that I gave them my last quarter for. And that was it. That was my existence in Alcoholics Anonymous. And nobody threw me away, and nobody said I didn't have enough or I hadn't done enough, or nobody even said anything to me other than, just don't drink and use in between meetings. We'll pick you up tomorrow night. And that was all I said. Don't drink and use in between. We'll pick you up tomorrow night. And I started to sleep. I slept. And there I was at 31 days not raising my hand. I thought, it's 31 days. I don't have to raise my hand anymore. I'm not really an alcoholic. I'm just on a pit stop in life. You know, I'm just here for a little while till I get it together, go to court, feel better, then I'm gone. But the magic of Alcoholics Anonymous began to work because of the love. Because people took time to pat me on the back. Because people took time to explain things to me, like, you know, I remember one day at a time someone said, "Do you want to ride to tomorrow night's meeting, Sharon?" And I couldn't say much because I had this wired jaw. The first 3 months I was here, I had to nod a lot. You know, I had to learn to listen is what it was. It was a beautiful way of opening up my ears. And they said, "You want to ride tomorrow night?" And I said, "Oh, it's a day at a time." I was so confused, you know. And an old-timer heard me say that, and he took me over and showed me his book of his commitments, which were months ahead. And he said, "But how do you feel right now?" You know, and if you're a good newcomer, you got to make them think about it and stand there while you think about how you feel right now for a good 5 minutes, you know. And I remember thinking about that, and it's like the Rolodex brain. You just spin it and spin it and spin it, and finally it lands on a card. You know, and you read the card, and the card always says fine. Always says fine. So I told him I was fine, you know. He said, "Well, that's what we're talking about. But you can make plans for tomorrow night for a ride. Go over and get those plans." "Oh, okay. You know, but just worry about yourself emotionally right now. Just right now where you are, okay? You're okay right now." And people were kind to me. They gave me things like change to call my sponsor, because I thought I had to go back to New Orleans to get my clothes, and I was trying to panhandle bus fare from the old-timers. And they would give me change and say, "Call your sponsor, kid," you know, and everything was kid all the time. And pretty soon I got a sponsor because of peer pressure. I don't know about you, but there were people in my group that kept sticking fingers in my face. And so I wanted to get a sponsor just, you know, as Camille, I remember. It's just because I was an arrogant little snot. I wasn't going to let you know that, but I got a sponsor just so you wouldn't stick your finger in my face anymore. And what happened was the sponsor moved me from a floor to her couch. My life got better instantly when I got a sponsor. It was that simple for me, and Janet was great with me. She said, you know, the first step, okay, you know, and she read me some stuff, and I, you know, she had me read 3 pages of the book a night, and it was all I could do, you know. It would put me to sleep, and I couldn't remember what I read, and I would read a paragraph and go, okay, what was that? And I was just like Swiss cheese. Everything would just kind of go through the black hole there, and I would try to read these 3 pages a night because I was, you know, I was in her house, and I was eating, you know, her food as I put in the blender. I had to eat blended food for 3 months, and I remember I stuffed up her garbage disposal, and I thought she was going to kick me out. I was so frantic, and she had me take walks and notice the colors and come back and report to her the colors I had seen. That's how I was. You just kind of put me out there, and I, you know, colors. I'd write them down, come back, and show her the colors I saw. I went to 2 meetings a day, and I was out of it. I was out of it. You just kind of pointed me in the right direction, and she made me get on my knees at night, though, and I thought, I didn't like this at all. And so I prayed to that empty sleeping bag for a long time. I mean, it was just, that's what it was. There was nothing there. But she gave me a little prayer. "Thanks for all you've given me. Thanks for all you've taken away from me. Thanks for all you've left me." So I would read this little prayer every night on my knees, make sure she was dead asleep. And She said, I worked step one because she had become my sponsor, and I admitted my life was unmanageable, and I raised my hand for 30 days, so I admitted I was powerless over alcohol, and fine, that was good enough for her, and that I had done step two because I didn't go back to New Orleans to get my clothes. I wanted to run, and I was crazy and frantic, and I sat through that feeling, and I believed in her more than I believed in myself. That, you know, always have a sponsor louder than your own head, if that's works for me all the time. That's how I had done step two, that I had listened to her and I had put my insanity, you know, I believed her over my insanity, and okay, fine, you know, I didn't know any of it. I was just kind of walking along with her, and then we did step three. And there's an action to step three, which is she had me get on my knees with her and read this out of the book. And I don't know about you, but I was embarrassed. She didn't draw the shades. It wasn't a dark room. The kids were there. She did it on, you know, in her living room. And we got up and she gave me the big hug. And Janet's half Mexican, half Indian, and very short. And she just stuck her face right there in my, you know, my midsection there. And just kept hugging and hugging on me. And then it started to feel good, you know. I thought, I must be gay. That's it, you know. I had no idea who I was or what I was. No idea. Now, this is how my mind was working, and I had no idea what it felt like to have unconditional love given to me like that. So then we started on four, and she'd say, how's it going? And yeah, it's going. Yeah, all right. You know, I got a $24 a week apartment, I got my wires taken off, I got a waitress job, I got a car, an old car, it was a great car, named Sassafras, you gotta name those cars. And I got insurance, they made me get car insurance, and, you know, they made you do stuff like that. And a phone, register everything in your own name, and I got a teddy bear where I worked, some kid left it, never came back, and I got this teddy bear, and I taped Just for Today up on my window, or in my mirror, and she said I had to say, I like you 3 times in the mirror every morning, and catch my eyes in the mirror. Oh, God, it's a silly little thing to do. So I would try to, there's a corner here, you know, and I'd see that Just for Today taped here, and I would, like, kind of zip in the corner. I like you, you know, right? I tried 3 times trying to not to really catch my eyes too much, but I knew she'd ask, you know, and she gave me these stupid little exercises like this to do, and then I'd go off to work, and I have a bad attitude. People ask me how I was, I tell them. They didn't want to hear it. They just want food, hot, you know, on time, and they taught me how to do the Al-Anon smile, so I learned how to do this, and... They said, you know, nobody's going to tell that you don't care. They just go up there and just act like you care. I said, they're going to know. Isn't this Alcoholics Anonymous? We're supposed to be honest in all our affairs. She said, no. Up there, they don't care, really. They just punch a time clock, show up on time, leave your mind in the car, and go to work. And I called her up one morning, and I said, I can't go to work. I have the brain tumor. And she said, you're thinking again, aren't you? And... So she said, you know what? If you die at work, we'll give you this great funeral. We're going to say wonderful things about you. We'll have flowers and a wonderful eulogy. But if you die at home in bed, no funeral. She hung up the phone. You know? This is my loving sponsor. She made me so mad. I got up and I tied those white shoes and I shoved myself into that orange waitress uniform. It was orange, brown aprons. And I went off to work and I gave him that toothy smile, you know, and I started, and then pretty soon, the people were nice to me, you know. They were getting their food on time, and they got their coffee, and people started being nice, and the tips were good, and I started to forget about myself and my brain tumor and how I felt and all that, you know. By the end of the day, I was all ready to call her up, you know, at 7 in the morning, so I'm going to call her at 5 o'clock and tell her, you know, her program sucks, her life sucks, everything she tells me sucks, and that's it, I'm leaving. And by 5 o'clock, I was having a really good day counting my tips, you know. I had totally forgotten about me. And that was just such a wonderful experience. And I learned that you just show up. I could sit at home. The committee is ready to go before I wake up so much of the time. And if I listen to them, I'm screwed. I have to just show up. My best friend, a part of my body, my best friend are my feet. My feet take me to where I'm supposed to go. My feet put me in the car. My feet get me to my job. My feet get me to meetings. My feet get me to commitments. My feet have me get up and cook my son dinner. My feet have me do things. You know, my mind doesn't. My mind is not my friend. My feet are my friend. So I treat my feet real special. And I just kind of listen to my mind, and I humor them sometimes, and that's about it. But, you know, it centers in the mind. And I got to be with you so that I get that peace from it. And my life started. That fourth step was on the back burner. I met him. He was wonderful. You know, roses and poetry and 6 more months sober than me. I read his 4th step. I knew all about him. He had me read it. I didn't sneak it. And, it was the greatest story ever told in his life. So, work of art. And, so we start going together. One night, she sees me standing outside with some newcomers. And I'm talking to these newcomers, right? Like, I'm not a newcomer. I have about 9, 10 months of sobriety. And I'm telling them about life. And all of a sudden, she said, "You better get your own higher power. You're going to get drunk." And she embarrassed me. What is she doing? Embarrassing me in front of these new people I'm trying to talk to. And she walked on by, and I said, "Janet, come here." And there was a Beacons moving truck at that moment sitting across the street or driving by. I said, "Look, that's my higher power, Beacons." And I started to explain to her, and the newcomers are understanding me, but she's kind of walking on, that my life was like a constant movement, and Beacons is like God, and the quilts that they wrap around those things, where God wrapped those quilts around me as I went through my life, and here I am with you, and Alcoholics Anonymous, and the newcomers are getting it, and Janet's just going, "I don't care as long as it's not you." And she walks on by. So I prayed to Beacons just a long time. I'd say, "Beacons is still my higher power, Janet." She said, "Good, as long as it's not you." She didn't care. And I don't know about you guys. I don't know if you have them up here very much, but I'll be anywhere. I'll be in a different state. I'll be in a different town. I'll be frantic. I'll be lost looking for a meeting. And I always see a Beacons truck. It's just something about it. And I always take a deep breath all the way down to past that, plate glass that sits in the stomach, and it goes past and warms me up. And I know I'm not in charge. Oh, thank God. Thank you, God. Thank you, Beacons. It just worked for me for a long time. And at 4th step, I almost got drunk over it, 11 months of sobriety. And I want to share that with you because I was very afraid. And I didn't know it was fear. I thought it was just my anger. I was really an angry person, and I didn't even track on how mad I was. And I was at the airport one night. I was going to go to Las Vegas and have my slip before I had my 1 year birthday and committed to Alcoholics Anonymous for life. So I thought I would go have my slip. And I called her from the airport. She's a good sponsor. She went to sponsor school. I know she did. She told me the Stella story that I think they all learned in sponsor school. And she said, "Be like my friend Stella. She wouldn't finish her inventory either," she added. "She went off and had her slip at 11 months. She burned up in a bed. Go have fun." Burned up in a bed, huh? How'd she burn up in a bed, I want to know about this burning up in a bed stuff. And so pretty soon I'm at the airport, and I'm so mad at her that she just took the wind out of my sails that I'm writing. I've got the pen is practically going through the pages. I'm so mad. But I'm writing. I'm writing. The anger was stronger than the fear. And I sat there in that airport till I don't know what time, and I wrote and wrote and wrote and wrote. And I finished that inventory, and we took it right before my 1st birthday. And there was no great feeling about it, but I remember after, it was an all-night affair, of course, and we sat on the beach in Venice and did it. And you just don't sit on the beach in Venice all night these days. And the policeman kept coming by looking at us like, "Are they still there? What are they doing?" They walked over once and looked, and we closed the books and sat there. And this just, it was personal. And they kept coming and checking on us all night long. And as I dropped her off, I looked up in the sky, and I thought, just one thought, one pure thought. This is the sky angels would be in. I don't know where that thought came from. It was a pure thought, and it was a fresh thought. And I sat a little deeper in my seat that night in Alcoholics Anonymous, and I looked at my friend Pat, who's now my friend, but she had 8 days less than me. She did her inventory months before I did mine. She seemed to give me that thin little blue-lipped look every time they would read chapter 5, because she knew I hadn't done my inventory yet, and I just resented Pat. There were many times that I was thinking of drinking, but I didn't want to have less time than Pat. You identify. So there I was, deeper in my seat, smiling at Pat as they read chapter 5 that night. And, next month Pat and I will both have our 19th birthday, and we get to celebrate together. So and I'll never let her forget. I still have those 8 more days. And my life went on, and I got involved in service in Alcoholics Anonymous. 6 and 7 I didn't work because I didn't have any. They were his. I don't know about you, but marriage seems to bring them out. A couple of years of sobriety, I got married. I think Tom was at my wedding. Tom is here, and I think he was at my wedding. And we had sobered up an alcoholic band who got sober to play at the wedding, and we had ham and cheese sandwiches and fruit. People brought fruit, and we got married by a Baptist minister, 2 ex-Catholics a day at a time, putting the vows. My sisters came out. My mother came out. My brother couldn't come. He was playing football. And my dad walked me down the aisle. And It was a great day. I was there. And at the end of the day, my dad looked at me and said, Sharon, look at your life. You got it made here. He had been to an Alcoholics Anonymous meeting with me, bought the big book, approved of all of you. And I thought, yeah, you're right, Dad, but you know something? I already had my own approval. It was like words I waited for my whole life, and they came just a little too late. Because I already had my own approval. It was like icing on the cake. It wasn't the whole cake. It was a nice day. It was a nice moment between me and my dad. And Alcoholics Anonymous gave me that. Things weren't all healed up there yet. At 5 years of sobriety, I got another sponsor. Jenny said, you know, why don't you pay him back the money you owe him? Maybe it'll be less tension between the two of you. And I thought, how does she know about the money I owe him? Smart sponsor. Went to school, sponsor school. And Jenny said, you know, why don't you call him up and ask him how much it is, and let's talk about some payment terms and see if he'll accept those. And I called him up, and I thought he'd say, oh, Sharon, you paid for most of your own wedding. You didn't go to Europe like the rest of the kids, and you quit college. I didn't have to finish paying for your college, so just don't worry about it. Nope, my dad had a figure ready for me like he was waiting for me to call. I know he sat there on a cold Iowa night and sat there with his calculator and worked it all out and put it in the big book and said, if Sharon calls, I'm not home, give her the bottom line, because she will get there if she gets to this part of the book, you know. My dad has 12-step people in the hometown. Just told him, I think you're an alcoholic. You should go to Alcoholics Anonymous, you know. He doesn't have any opinion one way or the other, but he has sent people to Alcoholics Anonymous. And he's also stopped some of my friends on the street and told them how well I'm doing. And that's amazing. Because I used to light up his eyes when I was a little girl, and that light was gone for years. And Alcoholics Anonymous has put that back in. And it's not just because I wrote him the amends and I try to live a pure life way out in California and stay out of his hair. It's because I sent him that check every month. Every month. And my sponsor was a sponsor that was wanting more for me than I wanted for myself, because she had me put a note in with that check every month. And I said, my dad doesn't want to know about my life. She said, do it anyway. So I wrote this note and I stuck it with the check, and it went off every month, whether I had the money or not, whether I thought I was overpaying him or not. Didn't matter. That check went off every month with that note. And it was between Christmas and New Year's, about 3.5 years later, 3¾ years later. My dad called me up and he said, Merry Christmas, Sharon. I don't want any more of your money. No more checks. Your debt with me is free and clear. Whew. And I got off light, I'll tell you. But he added a line that made a whole difference in my life. He said, don't stop sending me your notes. And me and my dad got to walk into a guilt-free, brand-new relationship. Now, it talks about relationships being restored here because of the work you do in Alcoholics Anonymous. And it was, at that moment, the chips on my shoulder just kind of fell on the floor. And I get to go be his little girl again and bring the light in his eyes. And I just came home about a month ago and rode around, and he's got a little golf cart that he comes up to the house back and forth, and down to his garden, and he, you know, we went out there with a salt shaker and sampled his garden, and he told me about all his garden, and we went into town together and introduced me to some of his pals where he has coffee every morning, and he's proud of me now. He can bring me out because of you, because of Alcoholics Anonymous, because of the 12 steps, because somebody took the time to give me their love, because somebody took the time to walk me through those steps. I started to work on my own defects of character well into my sobriety. I didn't know I had any until I became unnumb. And I started making more amends. And in 1980, we went to New Orleans to the International Convention. And boy, oh boy, I thought, New Orleans, oh my God, they're going to lynch me. And I went back and found my old friend, my old roommate Robin, and my old roommate Denny. And Robin doesn't remember me 12-stepping her. She was on my bed drunk at the Hyatt Hotel with a big book under her arm. And Denny didn't recognize me, and the word was out that I was back in town, and I walked that French Quarter, and I had old bosses just fall all over themselves because of what Alcoholics Anonymous had done with me, and I was an example. It was a powerful example of the change, just the physical change, let alone the spiritual and emotional and mental changes that happened. And about 10 years ago, I got a phone call, and Robin was in Minnesota, and she called me. She said she was sober in Alcoholics Anonymous. And about 4 months later, Danny called me and said she was sober in Alcoholics Anonymous. And 5 years ago, we met in Oklahoma for the first time, all of us sober, and we sat in this room, and it was pouring rain. We couldn't go out. It was a camp with a conference, and you were supposed to be going out playing volleyball. Now everything is like, you know, 2 o'clock this, 3 o'clock this, four, and it was raining, so we had to sit, and we sat in this room, and we hadn't been together in a long time, not since our drinking days, all three of us. And we sat in this room, and we talked about spiritual things. We talked about people that we love that are dead from the disease. We talked about how lucky we are. We talked about our gods. And I thought, seconds and inches. You know, 90% of the people I drank with in New Orleans are dead or dying. And we were plucked from that darkness. My two best friends and me. And Robin asked me to sponsor her that weekend. I had the privilege of walking the steps with her. And Danny became a public defender for the city of New Orleans, went back to school, and we're so proud of her. And last year, she found out that I was part of a general pardon from the governor of Louisiana, and I'm now a free woman. I am not a convicted felon anymore. I can really check no now, and on that box. I guess unless they're an FBI agent, and then I have to tell them the truth or something, but we hope we don't run into one of those. And Robin is one of the lights of my life. I get to sponsor a lot of people in Alcoholics Anonymous. I had a baby in 1984. My life was grand. I mean, I had gotten some really good jobs. I had became a travel agent. I had a lot of fun. I had to get over my fear of flying. I remember my sponsor writing me a note one day, God either is or he isn't. You know, where does that line come from? And so I had to sit on the plane, and I had to have, you know, faith over fear and chance all the way down. And you know, I'd have my underwear folded in the drawer, and please don't call me for a 12-step call before I go out for this flight. It's a sign, you know, and I knew we were going down. I mean, every time I got on a plane, and I had to let God get on before me, and I had to really find faith at a deeper level. And, you know, my God became a God that wore aviator glasses and, you know, big white scarves and long robes and would sit there in first class. There's always a seat in first class, so that's where God would always sit, and I would feel safe just knowing God was with me on the plane. And it was one of the biggest fears of my life I had to get over. And I had a fear of being shot, and I had to go through that, and I had to work the character defect steps on that, because there was a lot of fear involved, a lot of anger still, and a lot of resentment, and I had to go back to New Orleans and deal with that, my friend being shot. I didn't know they passed around the hat and Pat O'Brien's to bury this man. I never knew that. I ran from that situation, and I got to go back to New Orleans, and my host was the manager of that bar, and he told me that story. And then I found out the story about what had happened that day, and I was able to put that to rest as I was back in New Orleans in a cemetery there. And there's a way to put to rest the demons of your past, no matter what it is, with the 12 steps. And I had this baby, and I was really happy, and my husband was shaping up, and he was a punk rocker for a while, and it wasn't really that much fun, and I had to go to Al-Anon and learn to release him and quit burning up his dead Kennedy's records in the oven, and I was working with others in Alcoholics Anonymous, and he was going to dead Kennedy's concerts and the Cramps concerts and all those punk rock groups, and I'm going, is this sobriety, you know, and I had to let him go, and he came back to Alcoholics Anonymous and stopped going to flotation tanks, and he didn't drink, you know, and he got committed in Alcoholics Anonymous, and we went backpacking in the High Sierras, and I got pregnant. And I had this little boy in 1984 with all his fingers and all his toes, and we went to pick up my sponsor who was getting off a plane from Paris where she had been working in a play, and she had 21 days. She was supposed to have 21 years, and she was smoking pot. And she gave up her sobriety and came home, and she drank last September, and I don't know if she's back in Alcoholics Anonymous now. She's around, but I don't think she's back in the fellowship and the sunlight of the Spirit. And this is my sponsor, the woman that I just revered and loved, and I was crushed. I brought this little baby to see her, and I found out she had 21 days, and I just was crushed. And I went and I saw Clancy, and I said, look, you're ahead of us on this road here, you know. You're light in the path. I don't really have liked you all these years, but I don't think I can run you out of here, and would you be my sponsor, you know. And, well, let me think about it, you know. He was kind to me. I was angry, and I was upset, and he was kind to me. And I was so glad he was my sponsor at that beginning, at that time in my life, because after 10 years of sobriety, my husband decided to leave. And I had enough self-worth that I couldn't hang on his leg and comfortably tell that newcomer I'm working with to look in the mirror 3 times a day and say, I like you. I couldn't say, please, I'll do anything. Just let me be the victim if I have to be. Don't leave me. Because I had become responsible. By becoming responsible, I became less of a victim. The more responsible I became in life, the less of a victim I became. I never had that together. And I had to let him go. And nobody got custody of the meetings, and his new girlfriend was there, and it was really pretty hard, I'll tell you. I'm not working, and I have this baby, and I'm angry, and I'm sponsoring all these women who are beginning to jump ship, because I'm doing things like cutting my hair and dyeing it Madonna blonde. I'm walking around angry and uptight, and I'm not eating, I'm not sleeping. You know, I think I'm in a depression, but I'm not even aware that I am. I'm so angry, and I went and played the softball because she played softball, so I wanted to play her team, you know, and not one of her balls ever got by me that I remember at a game, ever. I got hit in the face, I got hit in the leg, I got my nose broken at one game, you know, so I got my nose reset, I got these black eyes, Madonna blonde hair, I was wearing these tight t-shirts and tight jeans because I weighed about 110 pounds or something. Sitting with my arms folded, my legs kicked out in the front row, and people walk by and go, "This is Sharon, she's got 10 years, she wants what she's got." You know? I was sick. And I got a lot of sick babies at that time in my life that didn't even know how sick I was. And we started working the steps again, and I started working the steps again. And my sponsor looked at me one night. I was headed over in their corner with black coffee to see how spiritual he and her were. And they were going to get married, and good for them. You know, this divorce was really painful and really hard for me because I married for life. I don't know about you, but I'm going to sign those papers. It's going to be for life, and you can't do this to me. But God has a bigger plan, and I fought and screamed and yelled and cried, but I didn't drink. And I was on my way to get him one night at a meeting, and it was Saturday night. Clancy's always gone on the weekend, but he happened to be there, and he happened to see what I was doing, where I was going. He remembers, you know, people that did that kind of stuff. And I was on my way with a hot coffee to the corner of the room, and he stopped me, and he said, "Sharon, you'll walk through this with dignity and grace." I thought, I don't care about dignity, and I don't care about grace at the moment. I care about revenge. You know? But he added, because he always adds one more thing louder than my head, so that you can be an example to the others. I heard him. I don't know what hurt him, if it was my ego or what, but I heard him. And I sat in my seat that night with my arms folded and my legs kicked out, but I didn't throw the coffee on him. I gave up the spare keys to my ex-husband's car because I was going to have a set, and I was going to drive it in the ocean. That was another thing I was going to do. I was driving the freeway 110 miles an hour as fast as my car would go, waiting for the lights to come on so I could hit the center divider because I was really in a lot of pain. I was in the hallway, and I didn't know it. I thought I was thrown out in the wolves, and nobody in Alcoholics Anonymous cared or loved me anymore. How come you guys didn't tell me this was going on? Why didn't you? How can you let him act like that, you know? And I had to put my eyes back on me. I had to give up my shoplifting. I was out shoplifting that Christmas. I'm 10 years sober shoplifting because I hurt so bad. I wanted to get put in jail. So they call my sponsor and say something. And he would probably say, "Leave her there," you know. But I had to go make amends for shoplifting. 10 years of sobriety. I never even did that before I came to Alcoholics Anonymous. But I didn't drink. And I started to work the steps again. I sat by a heater and I wrapped myself in my mom's quilt and I started to write. And I shared that with my sponsor, and we walked ahead. And something I learned was God didn't leave me. You know, God was always right there. You know, like that silly footprints thing. God was within. At 7 years of sobriety, I had had a spiritual awakening from the tip of my head to the tip of my toes. And I think the awakening for me wasn't any big thing other than I had just moved more to the place where God is. I cleaned enough crap away that I just moved a little bit towards the place where God is. And God was within me now, incorporated in my life, in my guts, in my soul, in my heart because of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I couldn't rip God out. And I get mad at God. Just go away, leave me alone so I can drink. And God would be there. So I had nothing to do but keep walking in that hallway. And finally one day, as I was sitting in a Catholic church waiting for the nun I sponsor, so I did make my amends to the Catholic Church, I had a healing. And it was 1 year, 1 month, and 18 days after that man walked out of my life. And I realized I was just in a hallway. I wasn't thrown out in the woods. Nobody said, "You're hopeless, you're useless." I was just in a hallway of growth. And I don't know about you, but I have realized now, after many hallways, whenever I'm in a hallway, I think it's going to be that way forever. Nobody understands my pain. I think we all identify with that. And it's always going to be this way, and there's no hope. But now when I'm in a hallway of growth, I take off the blinders. I get out of self. I look to my left. I say, "Hi, why are you in the hallway? and I listen to you a while. I look to my right and I say, hi, why are you in the hallway? And I listen to you a while, and I get a little relief, and I don't feel so alone. We're all in the hallway. Okay, good. There's a few of us here. We're all right. And then, you know, you hear that somebody got through the next door, and you're happy for them because you know your turn's coming. You know your turn's coming. They used to say don't leave 5 minutes before the miracle. You know, tomorrow might be the day. Don't do it. You know, make it till midnight, go to sleep, and just get up tomorrow. And it's always more intense at night. I don't know. It's just always more intense at night. In the morning, things feel different. And a lot of times, you know, if I'm not sleeping and I'm not eating or whatever's going on with me, you know, if I just make it till the morning, I'm okay. And I've never been in that kind of pain since, because God just reached inside of me and loved me again. And I got to walk up to the altar of that Catholic church and meet my nun friend and go to dinner and tell her about what had just happened to me. And this little boy had some problems. He was kicked out of kindergarten, and I thought, oh boy, here we go. And I called my sponsor. He said, give him to Sheila. So I called Sheila, who was principal of that Catholic school, and I said, you want him? And she said, sure, bring him over. We'll love him. And my son got loved, and he got a sense of security, and he turned around. And I could have lost him. 5 years old, you know, labeled a bad kid already. He's a great kid. He's a wonderful kid. He's taught me how to play. You know, he said to me last year, he said, you can't do a cartwheel, can you, Mom? Let me show you. He just turned 10. We just had his birthday party. He beat me in the race. I couldn't believe it. He is fast. And we go shoot hoops, and he's always beating me. But I'm hanging in there. I'm a good mom. I go out there, and I try to play with him. And he's taught me how to play. And he comes to Alcoholics Anonymous, and he meets the other kids, and he has a good time here. And, you know, it's like no big deal. He does tell me he's 10 years sober, though. He just done 10 years sober. And he told all the second graders about his mom in AA because they were reading AA mail, and he shot up his hand and said, my mommy's in AA, and told everybody about me. And the teacher went and told the principal, I think you'd find this very interesting, and told her about that. And the principal knew because I sponsored her, so. So that little kid has helped me come 180 degrees with that Catholic Church. You know, they talk about love and peace and service. And I heard him talk about something that these kids were learning about Mother Teresa. And, you know, Mother Teresa says that, the fruit of faith is love. And the fruit of love is service. And the fruit of service is peace. God, I look for peace my whole life. Wow. Alcoholics Anonymous has healed that relationship with that ex-husband. You know, he got married, they had a baby, I ended up hanging out with him because of the kids, and I started to like her, and I thought, why am I liking her? I hate her, really, but she's a nice person. And so we started doing things together with the kids, and pretty soon we had these things that we go ski trips together and take the kids to, you know, shopping and the movies. And I thought, God, you know, she's my friend, what's going on here? I hated this woman. And you know, they've been divorced a couple years, so it's a lot easier now, you know. But she told me that I was her example of walking through it with dignity and grace when he left her. So you never know who's looking. You never know who's looking. And Alcoholics Anonymous has touched my life. It's touched my soul. It's touched me deep in my toes. He married an Al-Anon, so he's doing okay. He really is. Recently, at her 10-year birthday, we were all sitting around having a family photo taken at Jill's 10-year birthday, wife number two. And I love to call his work and go, tell him it's wife number one, you know, ex-wife number one. And because we're all sober and she's an Al-Anon, but we were kind of jostling for the best place in the fireplace. We were trying to get our pictures taken, and we're all laughing, having fun. And the newcomer's saying, now, who's married to who, and whose kids are whose? And just shaking her head. It's just too confusing. And, you know, because I'm there with my kid, Jill's with her kid, and Al's there with his new wife and her kid. And so we're all kind of sitting around the fireplace, and they take this picture, and I got the photo. It's a really nice photo, but wife number three's not laughing yet. She's not, you know, not having fun yet. But if she hangs in there, she'll learn to love us in a very special way, I know. The day of my son's first communion, his dad had a heart attack, and he's a young man, and it was a little scary. And
When I walked in that room, his son was fine with it. Went up and grabbed his dad's hand, and I went up and I just fell apart. And I thought, why am I falling apart? I've walked past this. I have this great man in my life now, and it's way past this. And he was having these leg cramps and in a lot of pain, and he taught me to be of service, and I just started rubbing out his calves, rubbing out the leg cramps until the nurse could come, and something happened at that moment. I was being of service. I realized I had never wished him all the happiness, joy, love, prosperity that he deserves in his own life, and I was able to do that, and I was able to really cut the cord and walk that day by being of service and by loving him. And I have this great guy in my life, and I think that something happened about 7 years ago. I fell in love with this man, the Alcoholics Anonymous, I had known a long time. And I started to go to work for a bunch of powerful men in this law firm, and I could never look men really in the eye. And because of that healing with my dad, I was able to do that. And I've been there 7 years, and they just keep promoting me, and they say, good morning, how are you? I don't tell them. I say, I'm fine, thank you, how are you? And I go about my business. Yeah, I go about my business. And I work very hard, and I have a lot of fun there because I know God's in charge. They're not. And I have a lot of fun with my life. I sponsor an awful lot of women. Women in Pony, Montana, and Boston, Texas. A lot of them in Southern California. We have a good time, and we have a step study that meets at my house, and we try to get together and do that. We're on sabbatical for the summer, but we're going to start back up in the fall. And I get to see the joy in people's eyes. You know, Casey and I got to go back to New Orleans, and I got to go back and eat at Antoine's. I always wanted to do that. And there's a man I love on my arm in a private room at Antoine's with Robin and her husband who came in from Boston, and Denny and her boyfriend, and it's a celebration of sobriety, and we're eating in a private room at Antoine's, being waited on by a sober waiter, just being spoiled to death. And Robin's got her mink, and everybody looks pretty and clean, and we walked down Bourbon Street, and I thought, God, seconds and inches, but for the grace of God. You know, I looked in those bars, and I see people passed out on their arm, or throwing up on their shoes, or fighting with somebody down the hallway, and seconds and inches between me and them. And I got so grateful for Alcoholics Anonymous. My life has gotten just, I'm so excited about it. I'm going to be 19 this August, and I just feel like I'm just beginning. I hope I never feel like that I've learned everything here. And the way I get that excitement and that joy is by talking to Susan. By looking in her eyes and by knowing that if she just keeps coming and lets us love her, that the light will come on in her eyes. I used to think freedom's just another word for nothing left to lose. I lived by that. I had nothing left to lose when I came to Alcoholics Anonymous. And I found out that freedom is the 12 steps. Freedom is a loving God. Freedom is allowing me to let my God touch the God in you. Freedom is allowing you to look at me, and freedom is allowing you to let me see you. Just as we are, heart to heart, because it's the language of the heart. And I hope when we go home tonight that this excitement and this joy and this all this high we've had all weekend of being together, that you just take it to your home group, that you find a newcomer, and you watch the light go on in their eyes. Because that's hope. Thanks so much.